a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Senate Ag Committee will come to order. Welcome to those here today. We're running a little behind, but I think that first day of getting back in the groove, and we appreciate your patience. A few short, but we do have an official quorum at this point. I would like to greet the Internet listeners. We are going to have an overview and briefing from the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks by our Secretary, Jeff Bonk. And at this time, I'd have the first reminder of the cell phones, get back in that groove. And then second, let Cindy, our Secretary, call the roll.
Pagalka.
Here.
Frerichs.
Here.
Frisley.
Here.
Hansen.
Here.
Rampelberg. Roden. Valley.
Here.
Maher. Krebs.
Here. Quorum is present. Since this is our first meeting, we don't have an approval of minutes. For those testifying, welcome, Senator Roden. For those testifying, please sign in at the back there at the podium by the door for our Game, Fish, and Parks folks. Again, today we have a change as far as the listing on the committee agenda. It does state a briefing for the committee from the Department of Ag. Unfortunately, some conflict came up since we had to reschedule again. That will be on Tuesday, January 24th, where the Department of Ag will be giving us their briefing. So today we have the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks, our Secretary Jeff Bonk. At this time, I'll let you proceed. Senator Frerichs.
Sorry to interrupt. I was wondering, could we introduce the interns who are our staff that we have, just so everybody knows who they are and who's working with us. If I could start, I have Robbie Canas is in the back. I suppose she's charging her computer. So Robbie's from Clear Lake originally.
Where?
Clear Lake. And then, of course, Mr. Schoenbeck up here, you guys have.
From Watertown.
Good. So we have Luke Schoenbeck from Watertown and Robbie Canas. There we go. And then our pages today. Tucker? Is it Tucker Trider? Where are you from, Tucker?
Selby.
All right. Thank you for the reminder, Senator Frerichs. At this time, Secretary Bonk.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Welcome back. My name is Jeff Bonk. I'm the Secretary for Game, Fish, and Parks, and I can't tell you how excited I am to have the entire committee agenda. I thought I was going to have to share it with agriculture, but now I can take my 15-minute presentation and expand it for an hour and a half. If that's acceptable to the committee?
Secretary Bonk, is the green light on?
It is.
Okay.
Do I need to be closer to it? Or? There we go.
Now we got the internet.
Sigh of relief.
Users being able to hear you.
I did bring a PowerPoint series of slides to basically use to kind of keep me on track as I talk a little bit about what's happened over the past year and some of the challenges that we in the department will be facing this coming year, and then certainly we'll have a lot of time for questions. So. My computer skills are somewhat lacking, and so my screen is blank. All right. There we go. Thank you. Well, first topic I'd like to mention is the completion of our outdoor campus facility out in Rapid City. It was a project that the commission, I think, had envisioned developing. It's probably been 10-12 years, certainly long before I came. In fact, the commission had basically set aside money to construct this facility about the time that I started in this position. So there was a budget set up, and folks had a vision to develop a facility West River that was similar to what we have had for a long time in Sioux Falls. Okay. So the Outdoor Campus West builds on 14 years of the success that we've had, as I mentioned, in Sioux Falls. The facility was completed, and we did a dedication ceremony in late September this past year. We conduct classes of all sorts, from cooking wild game to teaching people outdoor skills, fly fishing, canoeing, identification of both animals and plants, those kinds of things. We have a lot of classes that come through the facility. If you have not had a chance to see it, I would certainly recommend that you take a few minutes if you're ever in the Rapid City area. It truly is it's a facility that I think exceeded certainly my expectations. It's really a wonder. If you've been to a Cabela's with the way Cabela's does their displays, we have displays that certainly, in terms of quality, match what's there in terms of wildlife and fish, and it's done in a way that people actually learn something about what it is they're looking at in terms of prairie ecosystems, forest ecosystems, those kinds of things. I did want to mention that the construction was financed with hunting and fishing license sales and the excise tax that's collected federally on outdoor equipment sales. And also, the Parks and Wildlife Foundation was involved with a fundraising effort that raised $1.2 million in private donations that have been put into really these enhancements that I mentioned, these displays and exhibits, so that that we were able to develop what we would call a world-class facility. And again, as we've talked many times, there were no general fund monies used for the construction and for the ongoing operation of this facility. License sales, just a quick recap of last year, what we saw. As we all know, we experienced severe flooding, certainly along the Missouri River and also in the northeast part of our state. Because of the flooding, and I think in particular because of the news releases nationally about flooding that occurred along the Missouri River, many folks were scared away. In reality, of course, the flooded areas were somewhat limited below the dam sites. So fishing on Lake Oahe, for example, has probably never been better. And yet we had a hard time getting that message out about the quality of fishing. The access was wonderful. We had a bite that started in June and, frankly, is still going today, other than it got real cold all of a sudden. But people were fishing a week ago when we were having those 60-degree days, and the reports were phenomenal. We did recover from a really slow start early in the year in terms of license sales, so our non-resident fishing licenses were down, frankly, just very slightly compared to a year earlier, and our resident fishing sales were actually up slightly by the end of the year. So we did overcome the slow start with regard to fishing license sales. Small game licenses, again, were down. We would certainly attribute the decline because of our August brood counts, which we do every year, revealed that those pheasant counts done in August were down 40% from a year earlier. Of course, we're coming off of about 4 years of record high numbers for modern times in terms of our pheasant population. So it's not surprising it was down, but the 40% number was certainly significant and probably did have an impact on people reading that in terms of their desire to come. In spite of that, again, we're pleasantly surprised, I have to say, that we had less than a 5% reduction in our non-resident small game licenses. These are the pheasant hunters primarily that come from out of state. We still came close to 100,000 licenses sold to non-residents, and our resident sales were down just slightly as well, to about 89,000. Non-resident licenses to hunt on shooting preserves increased to just over 10,000. From our big game licenses, we sold just under 175,000 total. Many of those big game licenses come with two tags. That's the disparity you see in that. So we have double tag licenses where, for example, you might get an either sex or a buck license, but that would come with a doe license as well to encourage harvested does, which is really how we try and manage the deer population. As you all know, we've gone through a transition over the years to encouraging internet license sales. and certainly our electronic point of sale system, which is what's in operation, functions very well at retail outlets. So all the sporting goods stores that want to sell licenses, the large big box stores, Walmart, et cetera, have that facility and the ability to sell licenses to sports as they come through. I think the interesting point of this whole thing is that we're up to almost 90% of all of our big game licenses are now done on our website through the internet. And then 35% of the small game and fishing licenses are also sold directly through the internet. So it's certainly a customer convenience not to have to go to a store. I can certainly also understand that some retailers like that business. That's why they sell the licenses. And so there's a give and take on all of that. But for customer convenience, and especially big game where you can't just walk in and get your license, you have to apply, and many of those are through a drawing. I think it's really facilitated from a customer convenience perspective, good participation. A transition a little bit to our parks. Last year, camping, we were at approximately 240,000 units. That was down almost 10% from the year earlier. Year earlier, if you remember, we had record park use and camping. The reduction we attribute primarily to the flooding and the resulting park closures, which I'll talk a little bit more about here in a minute. Visitation was 7.2 million. And again, slightly down, but again, actually rebounded fairly strongly, especially if you consider the number of parks and recreation areas that we had to close because they were flooded out. Our revenue was down just 2% over 2010, which again was a record year. We had anticipated an increase because there had been a $2 camping fee increase established for that entire season, but because of the decline in camping and visitation, the revenue side of the picture was down slightly, 2%. Some projects, our walk-in area program, we again increased the number of acres that are leased from private landowners for public hunting. That number is up this past year to 1.3 million acres. And netted those landowners $2.2 million from our game fund. Walk-in area contract. We also, the USDA Farm Bill, the last Farm Bill, eventually they got rules out, which established what we call a voluntary public access program, which we did take advantage of, received about $618,000 from USDA, that we used as a signing bonus with an emphasis in the southeastern part of the state where land values and walk-in area contracts are harder to get in terms of being competitive. And we used most of that, or a lot of that money went as a signing bonus in that part of the state. Special access areas were 43,000 acres in the northeast part of the state. And then we also have a Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. Again, the basis of that is USDA dollars, kind of on a Conservation Reserve Program contract. The state match money for that is coming from our game fund. And the caveat, of course, and this is the trick, I guess, if you will, on this one, is that if you sign up for our CREP program as a landowner, you get your CRP payment and our share of the money, but you also allow public access on your land, and that's how we justify the use of our game fund dollars. So our target is the James River watershed. We have a goal of 100,000 acres to be enrolled in that program, and we're currently at 55,000 acres, and I was pleasantly surprised, frankly. I was concerned that with the public access requirement, we might not have the interest that we normally see through a conservation reserve program, but we are getting interest, and I guess at this point I report that I think we'll probably hit that 100,000 acres over the next couple of years, especially if we have more high water along the James River like we've had in recent years. I think that helps encourage folks to look for something that's a steady, stable income. Our Rawlings game production area, we installed a handicap accessible fishing pier. We also improved the parking there and established some trails along there. Ice fishing access provided was provided at 57 lakes last winter by our personnel and contracts with private contractors. We also did work to improve boat ramps and docks at Oak Lake, East Oakwood Lake, Brackey Dam, Lake Byron, Cavour, Snake Creek, and on Lake Francis Case. Partnered with the U.S. Forest Service on the Fort Pier National Grasslands to make repairs on Richland and Sheriff Dams. These are small impoundments out in the grasslands that actually provide really good panfish fishing opportunities for folks who take advantage of that. And so these were dams that needed to be repaired to maintain those stock dams and the fisheries that they provide. And then we also have continued to work to get the Rose Hill Dam south of Miller restored from a washout that occurred a year or two ago. This is just a picture of Rose Hill of what happened there when it washed out. A picture at our North Point Recreation Area along the Missouri River. This kind of is typical of what occurred in those flood areas below the dams this past summer. We had 42 state park units that were affected. 37 of those were along the Missouri River. I won't read through the entire list of park closures, but they were significant. When you look at Farm Island and Oahe Downstream, North Point, the loss of use of those parks for essentially an entire season is where we saw probably our biggest revenue hit and certainly the loss of recreation opportunity, because those are highly used facilities along the Missouri River. And then there's a list of the communities where we had leased areas that were also lost due to flooding as a part of that. We estimated, as part of the process of recovery, you have to kind of go out and figure out what the damages were once the water receded. We spent a lot of time this last year doing that. We estimate approximately $9 million in damage was incurred due to the flooding, and we're working both on our budget and certainly with the governor's office, and we'll be working with you folks as this session unfolds on a plan to get the funding back so that we can get these facilities back in operation and provide that recreational opportunity that people have come to expect. This is just a map of showing you where a lot of these places were. The two, Fisher Grove State Park was flooded. That's a Jim River facility that got flooded out. Lake Thompson is an area that is just, it's one of those basins that has continued to accrue water through these wet years that we've had. Had a lot of folks that had property along the lake that were either flooded, threatened with flooding, or lost access to their property because roads to get to their homes and their summer places were lost due to flooding. I've tried to work with the county in particular on providing alternate access sites. In one case, we were able to work a deal through a game production area, which would be highly unusual, to create a temporary road so these folks could get to their properties. Again, this is Oahe Downstream, where we essentially lost the entire season due to flooding right below the Oahe Dam. There's significant road damage in places. Again, this is down, I think this is, yeah, this is Farm Island. It was incredible, actually fairly impressive sight to see the flooding that occurred. This here, this is, I believe, almost at the outlet of the spillway from Oahe, where we had, you saw the pictures, I'm sure, on the news of the tremendous volumes of water that was released through those tubes. We lost, frankly, those waterfront campsites, and we had to move. We had a couple of several camping cabins that were located along there that we were able to get moved out before the erosion occurred, and we lost all that ground. So those are going to be relocated a little farther back, and that's part of our recovery efforts to establish those camping pads and reestablish those camping cabins, and we expect to be able to do that. But this type of erosion is going to demand also some protection so that we can avoid further erosion and protect the facilities that will be put back in place. I'll transition a little bit to our challenge with the mountain pine beetle. Our agency interest in particular is Custer Park, our crown jewel of state parks really across the nation. And what we're trying to do to keep up with the battle of the mountain pine beetle. This is an aerial photograph that kind of shows you the black elk wilderness that borders the park up around Sylvan Lake area. As I think most of you know, for several years we've had an effort to go in and remove infected trees around the Sylvan Lake area, and it's been a fairly effective program. We've worked closely in cooperation with our Department of Agriculture, and they've been a great partner and provided funding resources and helped with contracting. And we've been, as you can see from the map, we've been able to keep up with the incursion in the Sylvan Lake area. And to be honest with you, I think most foresters I've talked to, we expected that we could continue with this spot treatment of identifying infected trees and getting in before the next flight, which usually occurs in late June into July of these bugs, and get those trees cut up and knocked down in the Sylvan Lake area. We did a lot of removals. In some of that territory, last year, for example, our contract was we had to helicopter trees out because it's such steep terrain up in that part of the park. But it's been a concerted and sincere effort, and we've done a good job. The problem that we've found is that we had a flight last year that surpassed all flights, and the infection rate in trees across the park is much, much higher than anyone anticipated. We did a full park resource survey and inventory of those trees and identified somewhat over 140,000 trees that are infected that need to get removed this year. And so our effort in working with the Agriculture Department is to put a plan together to try and actually go in and do a total removal. When I say removal, a total kill. Some of those trees will be harvested and removed. Many of them will be, as this picture shows, just cut and chunked up and allowed to dry out on ground so that these beetles die before they fly. So we have crews in there today, as we sit here and speak together, actively working to cut and chunk trees in these infected areas throughout the park. It's expanded well beyond the Sylvan Lake area at this point. And we'll be, I'll throw a pitch in. If you're interested in finding out more about the efforts and the expenses, there is a briefing planned next Wednesday afternoon on the pine bark beetle, and our Department of Agriculture folks are going to lead that. And they'll talk much more broadly about the issue in the Black Hills in general and the efforts that the state has to help private landowners, and our Custer State Park efforts will also be a part of that briefing. So I hope if you have time, you'll take time to attend that. We also were able, we've talked for the last couple of years openly, and this is another long-term effort to try and acquire some property to establish the Blood Run historic site and what we hope will someday be a state park for the state of South Dakota. The Buzz Nelson property was 305 acres. It's a piece of property that's really at the core of our ability to establish this park. And we were able to sign the deal, if you will, with Mr. Nelson and a couple of partners to acquire that property in late December. So, you know about the historic. Here again, our Parks and Wildlife Foundation really stepped up to the plate. They went out and essentially locally, raised $1.6 million in private funding to help with the acquisition. The final purchase agreement, again, I mentioned, was executed in late December. It was done in, we basically, because of the financing and the nuances of who had money that was available to do what and when, the Parks and Wildlife Foundation holds a piece of that ground today. The Conservation Fund, a national organization, also was of assistance. They hold a piece, and then our department was able to directly acquire 10 acres. The plan is basically to transition from Parks and Wildlife and the Conservation Fund to department ownership as soon as we can secure the Forest Legacy funding that is out there pending. And I am happy to report that we have gotten word that we have an award of at least $500,000 of Forest Legacy that's not directly associated with this project, but that could be made available to help us finalize this deal. We're hoping for a project award, which would be more money than that, through that program, but need to see where the Forest Legacy program ends up in the federal budget negotiations that will occur over the next few months. We also, as a part of doing this and sort of being able to plan where we go from here, did contract with a firm who worked on putting together a master plan for the development of this area. That's been completed, and it provides both that short and long-term vision of where things can go and where we hope that they, in many cases, will go. That really helped assist with the acquisition, and certainly being able to answer questions that people that maybe had an interest in investing in this might have to, you know, how secure is it, what's the plan going forward, really helped us out a lot with that. The planning process involved extensive public input and visioning. We had strong, this is a, as you all know, is a very important historic and cultural site to our Native American tribes, especially from that have roots in that area. And there was an extensive amount of outreach to tribes that had a history there, and we had a lot of input and frankly support to move this project forward from the tribes. And we continue to work with the folks on the Iowa side of the Big Sioux River who also have an interest in this site and seeing it protected. So, pretty much, this just gives you, again, a refresher look at how close the site and the future park will be to the city of Sioux Falls. You can see, as we've talked in other briefings, that it's essentially right in the development path as Sioux Falls will continue to develop and grow. So it's really good, we believe, that we're able to make this acquisition and move forward with the park plan now before land prices continued to increase due to development pressures. Madam Chair and members, I appreciate the time that you've given me to kind of go through a few things that have happened and things that we're working on, and I'm certainly available to talk about items of interest to you if you have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Are there any other presentations from your department?
No.
Okay. Just want to make sure before we moved into...
At least not today.
Okay. We'll save that for a later date.
Yeah.
At this time, then, we'll move into committee questions. Senator Hansen?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. In the case of, you know, this is kind of near and dear to me because it's just not my back door, but the Rose Hill Dam that broke, do we have any provision for... addressing damage that's caused to private property owners downstream from the dam? I should probably know the answer to that, but I don't.
Mr. Secretary?
Madam Chairman, Senator Hansen, I don't know that we have, as a department, an answer, a financial answer to address those concerns. But this did occur as a flood event. And damages as from the federal government perspective, the FEMA certainly was out and about. And in fact, FEMA is helping defray the cost of the restoration of this dam to a significant degree. So, I mean, I think there are government services that are available to private landowners that incur damages as a result of flood. Most of those assistance programs are oriented toward restoration of public infrastructure, which is why, which is what the Rose Hill Dam is, and which is why it was eligible for, I believe, 75% cost share. But, you know, part of, I don't want to get too philosophic here, but when structures like dams are created, there's generally an understanding, and certainly there's a look at downstream potential damages if there were to be a failure. And oftentimes, zoning is put in place to protect for that eventuality, so that development in the floodplain below a dam structure is generally not allowed. But again, zoning and local land use is a local control issue, and certainly is in the purview of the county to make sure that once a structure is developed, that people don't put themselves in harm way through whatever the building and zoning code would be of that local county.
Further questions of the committee? Senator Frisley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to personally thank you, Secretary Vonk, and the Game Fish and Parks for the effort that you made to help the residents of Lake Thompson with that temporary road and able to get to their homes over there. That was really a great gesture on your part, and I feel that those people were helped immensely by this temporary road that you folks were willing to let them do. I did have a question, if I might. With the damage done to the parks and the boat ramps and that, and such an astronomical figure, are we going to be able to use some of those parks and boat ramps? Are there going to be, or is there going to be quite a number of them still incapacitated in this following year? So,
Madam Chair, Senator Frisley, first thank you for the comment regarding the GPA and temporary road. As you all know, when we have a game production area, there's generally federal involvement with the acquisition, which also brings federal involvement with long-term management. So I would say that's probably been our biggest challenge in doing things that are out of the ordinary. And in this case, the Fish and Wildlife Service worked closely with us to allow that to happen. And so I compliment the staff of the department and being able to work through some of the administrative hurdles that occurred in making that happen. The answer to your question on parks is we've really taken a hard look at the damages and where they occurred and what the opportunities are to restore these facilities for the coming season. And we believe that with the planned reprogramming of existing park dollars, we're going to have to delay some capital development that we might have otherwise had on the docket to get done to sort of reprogram that money into some of these repairs. We're hopeful in working with Budget and Finance and the Governor's Office that there'll be some other funding that would be made available. And then all of the coming fiscal year funds that we would have for capital development will be put into restoration. So that's a general response. I would tell you that as a specific, I believe Fisher Grove Park, for example, our problem with Fisher Grove is not only the recurrent flooding that we've had, but we have a bridge there that's basically been determined after this recent bout to be unsafe. So that facility most likely will not be open again until we are able to deal with this bridge, because the bridge is how you get to the camping and park facilities. And so that's one that we're not going to be able to address immediately. But Our most used areas, if our budget and our plans hold up, we expect to have in service this coming year, and so we've got a priority both in our budget to get things done between now and July 1st, and then the new fiscal year will kick in, and then we have a whole series of other projects that we think we can get done. But our plan is basically to have our parks up and running, if not 100%, certainly in the 90%.
Senator Frerichs.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Secretary Ivanka. I guess a question that you touched on a little bit with the small game licenses and stuff, but it seems like this drop in pheasant numbers was definitely a hot topic as we went throughout the summer and even into pheasant season, and it was definitely disappointing that the numbers were down. Do you folks envision, looking back, obviously last spring was an abnormal type of snowstorm I was traveling back and got stranded in good old Bristol on the way back home, of course, for our last day and stuff, so we certainly witnessed that. Aside from the habitat side, which I think is somewhat debatable because of different tree groves, and certainly there still is grassland, and different people manage pastures differently as far as what's left over, winter wheat and all those things. What sort of plans maybe could be put in place as far as partnering with farmers or producers, especially because I noticed, some people were feeding the pheasants, but what could be done to kind of have some, local buy-in, you could say. I realize the department has some dollars to help if there's a strong concentration on the deer, and I imagine they do that on the pheasant side as well. But are there some things that all of us could kind of work together to do our part? Like I said, aside, we realize habitat is really important and it's needed, but it seemed like last year as the winter progressed, feeding was an issue also.
Madam Chairman, Senator Frerichs, I guess I can't let you discount the importance of the habitat side. We have had to date a relatively mild winter, and I would suspect that if we return to those mild temperatures and don't have a lot of snowfall, and if we had a good spring with regard to nesting, that you'll see a rebound, especially in some places of the state, in our pheasant population. But long term, if we continue to lose habitat, conservation reserve program certainly is a good indicator of what's happening in our state. The high commodity prices and the opportunity to have more row crop production is definitely going to have an impact long term on our ability to maintain high numbers of pheasants. So feeding programs during times of high stress certainly can help. Our efforts generally are to work with landowners to mitigate depredation issues around feeding. Or around wildlife populations where they're having an impact on crop production or heavy grazing on hay ground, that sort of thing. We try and implement programs that'll short-stop wildlife, if you will, to help the landowner live with the depredation that's occurring from deer, or sometimes it's elk and sometimes it's even pheasants. But I think our bet long term is to work with folks on private land who have an interest to help them with habitat through both farm programs. There's the USDA programs that provide habitat opportunities, and certainly our farm bill biologists are out there working with folks, helping them understand what could be done on their property to provide that habitat really that will sustain these populations. So I actually think we have the tools available for willing landowners, and maybe that's not been communicated as widely and as well as it needs to be, and we'll certainly work on letting that happen.
Follow-up,
please. Follow-up? Thank you. I'll try to make it short here, but it seems like it's all or nothing in a way, though, too, with the CRP. The writing's on the wall. Once land is taken out of that CRP, it takes a tremendous amount of work to take it out. Obviously, the intent is that you're going to capitalize on the commodity prices, or you're going to realize that you need feed for livestock or whatever, and so those would be some of the issues there. But I guess I'm still troubled that there isn't more of a working lands approach And I know there are some programs, especially winter wheat and things like that, that have well intentioned, but and maybe I'm living in a different part of the world, but I look around and we have habitat that is abundant, and yet our pheasant numbers still suffered. And so I guess maybe that's something we'll see. But I guess encourage and anything that could be done, because with these commodity prices still holding fairly steady, and now things drying out along the Jim River area, good luck on getting the 100,000 that you hope to, as far as those acres. But I get emails constantly from folks that that are out of state landowners and are weighing their options. And right. Times are changing rapidly here, and I think many of us want to partner yet to encourage keeping the wildlife even aside from the habitat. Thank you.
Further comment?
Senator Krebs, Senator Frerichs, thank you for the comment. I share your concern, and to the extent that there's more that we can do with the resources that we have, I can tell you that we're committed to doing that. You live in a particularly tough part of our state with regard to pheasants. These last 2-3 years have been very hard winters, as you well know, and it's just been hard to... For those birds. I just remember driving through your part of the world last winter, wondering how anything who had to live out in the wild could survive. And it amazes me that we have birds left that actually did survive. So, anyway, thank you for the comment.
Senator Roden.
Thank you. Secretary Vonk, you had the slide up on the mountain pine beetle, Sylvan Lake area. We did the ag tour summer before last, and we saw some pretty dramatic views of, and come to understand very clearly that as a state, we've been very effective at controlling the pine beetle. Yes. We have the technology, we have the know-how, and we've applied that effectively. I guess I become more and more discouraged living just outside the Black Hills when I drive through the hills, seeing inch by inch our national forests being destroyed and the Black Hills turning from green to brown. And so I guess my question to you, first of all, two questions. What should be done in the national forest as far as, in your view, what could they do? If you were in control, what could they do to fix that? And the second question is, what can we do, the effective side of it, at the state level? What should we be doing to make a change and to see that somehow we don't lose the Black Hills?
Mr. Secretary?
Madam Chair, Senator Roden, those are good and difficult questions to answer. I certainly share the concern that you have expressed about the rapid spread of pine beetle damage across the hills, and it is serious. I sit on the Black Hills is, I think, only one of two national forests that has a Citizens Forest Advisory Board, and I am fortunate or otherwise able to represent state resource agencies as a member of that board. So that you and the committee know, the board did actually weigh in support of our delegation nationally, requesting that the Forest Service and the administration use its abilities to declare an emergency, because this truly is an emergency. And under NEPA, which would allow an accelerated series of forest cuts and thinnings to be advertised on a much more quick basis. The NEPA process for the Forest Service to go through its full scale with appeals and administrative and legal appeals can take years, frankly, so they can identify an area that needs to be thinned, and by the time they go through the NEPA process to get the okay and the ability to actually list the sale, years have gone by, and of course this beetle's not waiting for years to spread. so far the administration has been unwilling to do that. My understanding is that I'm hopeful. My understanding is there was another meeting on that issue yesterday. I haven't heard how that went. But that would certainly give the service an ability to be more reactive in a much more efficient time frame if they would take advantage of that provision in the National Environmental Protection Act or Policy Act. So that's one thing that could be done. On the other side of the equation, I would tell you that the folks on the Black Hills Forest have taken the approach of trying to do very broad, take a broad attempt at getting NEPA declarations on large areas, which I think they've been reasonable. It still takes a long time, but once they get the okay, they're basically, at this point, it's my understanding, the limit right now in terms of thinning and commercial harvest is basically with the commercial side of the industry, that they've got enough timber sales on board ready to go that exceed the ability and the capacity of the commercial side of things to be able to bid on those. So we're in a place now where we've, as a state, I think, and I was talking with the forest supervisor about this yesterday, asking some questions, if there was an opportunity, for example, if they put a bunch of sales out and three quarters of them get bid by the commercial side of things, but the other ones are left because either they're less viable or they're harder to do or whatever the reason might be, is there some way for another entity to enter into that without being considered sort of competition to the commercial side? And I think there may be something that could happen on that end of things as this moves forward. So I'm actually encouraged by the action in recent times of the Forest Service in terms of their ability to try and move these determinations forward in a sort of broader, more general pace. Problem, as you well know, is that they on the other side have to be very careful that they administratively carry out their work under those guidelines that are provided, because they're subject to lawsuit challenges at every step of the way. And so they have to make sure they dot every I and cross every T as they go through these processes. Otherwise, they can be stopped in their tracks. So things are moving better now, in my opinion, than they probably have in the last 2 or 3 years. I think we're at a better place. There's still challenges, but I think you're going to see a lot more action on the ground moving forward.
Secretary Vonk, if you could maybe give us a written update, if there were any changes or movement from that meeting yesterday, that would be nice.
Yes, Madam Chair, as soon as I would hear about that, I'd certainly be happy to provide the committee.
A written comment or a written piece of paper would be great. Senator Valley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple questions. And one set is regarding the mountain pine beetle. You say they are chunking them and leaving them. I'm assuming then that if the tree isn't moving sap, then that thought process and they don't move. And how wide is that path that we've put between? It seemed like one time we were talking, we put a path between the Custer State Park and the National Forest, and if we had a path, they only move so far. So when you say they're moving, is it the wind that moves them further, or how do they? You know, I'm looking at that, and you're saying we're seeing more movement. Is that because the wind, or they move farther? They're getting stronger wings as they're getting older, or what's the deal?
Madam Chair, Senator Valley, second question first, because I forgot your first one. We're not, at least from what I've been told by the foresters who have been more directly involved, we're not really sure what happened that caused this much more dramatic spread this past year compared to what was expected. I don't necessarily believe they've gotten stronger wings, but certainly wind events, if it's timed correct, you know, if you get a big wind event right when these bugs are emerging to make their flight, it certainly will spread them much further and wider than without having that. They generally don't fly that far. So that would be the speculation that probably there was something to do with a wind, pretty strong, helpful, in their case, wind event.
Clarification on the first question?
The other part of that question was how wide is a swath that we have normally used? And then to further go on that, what percent do we know? What is the percent that is infested in the national forest, and what happens in a fire situation? Would it burn up to Custer State Park, and then would that swath help us in any way? That is it wide enough to give us some kind of a fire defense, or is it just going to come right across there? I mean, if we've got a large percentage of the national forest and a huge fire starts, what happens here?
Madam Chair, Senator Valley, I'm no expert in this by any stretch of the imagination. Our treatment efforts have been to thin the forest and remove all of the infected trees, just leaving those healthy trees in a much thinner environment, which basically allows those remaining trees to thrive more, to basically live better and be stronger. It allows more sunlight, allows the forest to be a little drier than maybe it is in a real dense stand. All those things, I think, tend to help those trees fight off an attack by pine beetles. So your answer to fire, I mean, to me, the logic of that is that if you have a managed forest with healthy trees that are much thinner, you have hopefully a better ability to fight a fire. Now, when you start talking about a massive fire of the proportions that I think you're talking about, I don't think necessarily that what we've got is going to provide total protection. I would just close this, because I'm talking way out of school for me, to encourage you to come to that event next Wednesday. I know, I believe Joe Lowe is going to be a part of that, and he'll talk about the fire danger, and we'll be able to address your questions on specifically to what you've answered much more professionally and adequately than I can here.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. My other one question is on Blood Run. And am I seeing both? This is going to be, as we had talked on that tour, going to be on both sides of the river. And I'm trying to remember, is there access? What is the bridge access to get from one side to the other, and how is that going to work?
Madam Chair, Senator Valley, currently on the site itself, there is no bridge access across. So for you to get across, you have to drive either south or north to find a bridge that crosses the Big Sioux. Part of our sort of visioning process would envision maybe a footbridge that would allow folks on a hiking trail to cross from one state to the other. But again, that's probably at this point more of a vision than even close to reality. We gotta have the folks in Iowa sort of. We are quite a bit further ahead in our planning, in our acquisition, and in the vision that we have for the site than they are. And I know there's an intent from the folks that we've worked with in Iowa to move things along and try and catch up to where we are, at least in the visioning, and then make sure that what they're doing and what we're planning meshes to the largest degree possible. And so, but we did kind of have this idea that wouldn't it be great if you had your hiking trail and you could get from our side of the river, where you can see some of these really sacred burial sites, to be able to walk over and kind of actually experience that. And so we just need to get there with Iowa.
Further questions of the committee?
Secretary Vonk, I do have a couple here. The on the walk-in program, it stated a cost of about $2.2 million on that 1.3 million acres that we have available. What is the average lease? Is there a number out there that we could say would be the average? I know it's going to vary from area to area because of the differences in price and land values, but I'm just curious if you had a number.
I suppose you could divide the 2.2 by 1.3 million, and that would give you an average.
Is it significantly different then? And my question is, it significantly different in the southeast part or the eastern side or versus northeast?
Senator, yes, it is. And you know, we have lands that we get for 50 cents an acre, and we have lands that we pay upwards of $10 an acre. Mm-hmm. And the assessment made on that is basically the quality of habitat, the size of the, you know, what's the opportunity for primarily hunting, but I'd say all kinds of public access and recreation, and the size of the parcel, what it may offer. Those are all factors that go into what we pay, but generally speaking, our base bid would be somewhere between 50 cents and a dollar an acre for a run-of-the-mill ground, and where we have really high-quality habitat opportunities, like Senator Frerichs was talking about, in areas where that habitat's crucial, we may pay more for access on those spots.
One more question, Secretary. On the fishing licenses, and anybody that's over the age of 65, do they get a better price if they're over the age of 65 on a fishing license?
I sure hope so, because I'm headed there. But no, I believe the answer to that is we do give a senior discount for, I think it's both hunting and fishing. Is that correct?
Right now it's just the fishing, but the senior combination license.
Yeah, that's the license.
The senior combination license is
hunting and fishing.
Hunting and fishing. And are there other states that provide, I should say, not just reduced rate, but free fishing licenses for those that are over the age of 65? Do you know?
Senator, I can't answer that either. There may be.
Is there a significant number of those licenses over the age of 65?
Senator, I don't know the answer to that either. If you would like statistics on that, I do think we have the ability to get into our database and gather some of that information.
Question on that. Thank you. Any further questions of the committee? Seeing none at this time, Secretary Vonk, thank you for your time today and your department. We appreciate the update. We were very fortunate. Those that did attend the Legislative East River tour did get to see that Blood Run facility, or the area, I should say. We appreciated that. That was very nice, giving us that opportunity with Buzz to actually speak with us. And so we appreciated that. So thank you for setting that up for us.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you.
Keeping us up to date. We appreciate that, and we'll try to attend that Mountain Pine Beetle meeting as well. If no further questions or comments from the committee at this time, the couple things. We have January 24th, which is next Tuesday. At this time on our agenda will most likely be an update from the Department of Ag. We may try to fit, hopefully, DENR in there as well. Hopefully, we'll have some bills as well getting there, but it's a slow start. We may see some, but at this time, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
I've got a motion to adjourn by Senator Valley, seconded by Senator Hansen. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Senate Ag is so adjourned.